Good afternoon and welcome on in to Kildare Focus. You're listening to KFM. It's Thursday the 12th of January 2023. It's Caoimhe with you here until 3 o'clock this afternoon. Coming up on today's show, we'll be speaking to Alex Cooney. She's CEO of Cyber Safe Kids and she'll be telling us how to post pictures of your children online safely if you don't want to delete them entirely. Then if you have trouble sleeping, you should stay tuned until 2:20 at least because Dr. Narina will be here. She's a physiologist and a sleep energy expert and she'll be telling us how to get a good night's sleep at any age from a baby to later life. Then we'll be speaking to Dr. Maeve Ogan. She's a consultant in obstetrics and gynaecology at the Rotunda Hospital in Dublin. Researchers at Trinity College have found the number of first-time mothers giving birth by caesarean is rising steadily. And then last we'll be speaking to Ivana Uchak. She's the Violence Against Women Coordinator at the National Women's Council. It's 1 year since the death of Aisling Murphy and frontline services are calling for greater action on the government's zero tolerance strategy. Of course, if you want to get in touch with the show, you know what to do.
Kildare Focus with Caoimhe Harney. Text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97.
Now, I was reading recently in a local paper that a woman found numerous pictures of her children, which were taken from her own social media account and posted on a separate account, which was, of course, a fake account. These pictures were taken without her consent and she proceeded to just delete every single picture that was on her social media of her children. She was just so distraught. And I'm joined now on the line by Alex Cooney. She's CEO of Cyber Safe Kids. And Alex is going to tell us how you can post pictures of your child safely online if you don't want to delete them entirely. Good afternoon, Alex.
Good afternoon.
Alex, is this a common thing that we see with people taking pictures from one Instagram or maybe your social media account and stealing it and putting it on a fake account?
I would say we have no idea how common it is, and that's the problem. You know, once you post something publicly or post it with a kind of very wide network, even if your account is set to private, you don't know how others are going to use that information or whether they're going to use that information. So I think it's something to really consider before we put pictures, particularly of our kids, out in a very public domain.
Okay, we often see, I know myself, a lot of my friends have pictures of their children up on Instagram. Some will put, you know, a little emoji over their face so that their face can't be seen. Others don't. Others are happy to have their child out there. In your opinion, is it quite dangerous to have pictures of your child online?
I mean, I think, you know, I suppose it could be. I mean, the article that you highlighted was very much a case of somebody who seemed to have, you know, wrong intentions using pictures of her children and trying to attract other children. And that is always a danger. And certainly we've come across that before. You know, we've had people ring us and say that this has been a problem and that they've contacted the social media platform in question and they have not managed to get that account investigated. So, you know, we've helped on those cases because, you know, we really should not be sharing things without consent, for first of all, and we should really consider what we're sharing and with whom we're sharing, and also, you know, what's in that photo, because I think a big pressure point is around, you know, the return to schools in August, September. And we see a lot of people posting pictures of their kids in their school uniforms and saying first day back at school. And there's so much information in that photo. You know, you could have the school crest, you could have the name of the school, you could have approximate ages of the children, names of the kids. So I think we do need to be mindful of what we're sharing when we're posting. And obviously it is possible to still share your pictures, but I think really consider who you're sharing it with and on what platform and whether you've privacy settings enabled and so on.
Okay, so if you're a parent out there and you want to keep your photo, maybe you've a lot of photos up and you want to keep them, how do you go about, I suppose, making sure people don't take your child's photo off your account?
Well, I think the first thing to do is check your privacy settings. You know, who are you sharing this information with? Hopefully, you know, say you're on Instagram or something, and hopefully you've already got that set to private. But do you, you know all of your followers really well? Because that's another thing to consider. You know, who are we sharing these pictures with? You know, ideally, we'd stick to sharing these sorts of information or this sort of content with private groups in, say, WhatsApp, which is end-to-end encrypted, you know, that you might have small family groups, friend groups that you can share these things with. But I would avoid, where possible, sharing them extensively on social media. And if you are, be really mindful of what is in the picture and how much information you're giving away, including sometimes the geolocation data, you know, which identifies exactly where the picture was taken and when it was taken.
Okay, so let's say someone has no children yet and they're due a baby in the next month and they're thinking, right, I do want to put my child's photo out there and share it with the world. What's the best and safest way of doing that? Of course, bearing in mind that you already have your settings set to private and you've gone through all of your followers and you know all of them quite well. What can you do after that?
Yeah, I mean, you of course, and people will continue to share, and of course, you know, and hopefully it won't ever be used. And the advantage with a baby photo is that sometimes they're hard to tell one from another. But I would, again, be careful about what I'm saying with that photograph, the exact birth date, the exact name. You know, this information can be collected and used, you know, in later years. But just being really mindful, I suppose, really tight follower lists. You know, so if you know everybody, you've got like 80 followers and you know them all, you know, really well, and you want to share this information. But if you've got 400 or 500 followers and you're really not in touch with a lot of those people, you know, I would be mindful, because you can share specifically with people, or even on things like Instagram, you know, rather than just showing it to your general post. So I think about who you're sharing it with and what you're sharing.
Yeah, exactly. Like sometimes WhatsApp groups are great for that. Like, you know, if you have 6 close friends, send in the picture to your 6 close friends instead of putting it up there maybe for the world to see, Alex, and that might kind of weed it out that way maybe.
Exactly, yeah. Set up a group for this purpose, you know, with your closest friends and family, you know, to announce the arrival of you know, the new baby, which is such a momentous event and absolutely to be celebrated. You know, it's incredibly exciting. But just, yeah, keep it to your tightest group of friends and family.
Okay. And in terms of then children who, you know, or people who have pictures of their children up online, there's a lot of controversy about it because some say, you know, that child doesn't have consent to say that they want their picture out there. And as we know, there are some social media influencers out there that have hundreds and thousands of pictures of their child up online. What would your stance on that be, you know, if the child gets to a later age and says, here, look, you know, there's 500 pictures of me online and I never consented to any of it?
Well, this is it. This is what we say often in our parents' talks when we're delivering them. You know, we need to think about the digital footprint of our kids. You know, we've probably created one for them before they've even had a chance to have any accounts on anything, you know, and post themselves. So, you know, I do think we need to be mindful of that and, you know, how they're going to feel in later years. So if you're sharing loads of, you know, pictures of them dancing around naked in a bath, you know, that could make them vulnerable later. They may be really uncomfortable with that. So I think, again, just being really mindful what you're sharing and what platforms you're sharing it on, you know, and consider that issue of consent. You know, something we would say to the kids as well, you know, don't be posting pictures of your friends unless you've asked them. You know, that's really important. You know, you wouldn't want pictures of you posted without your consent. You know, it's an important principle to adhere to. And I think as parents and caregivers, we need to be thinking of those same rules ourselves.
Okay, well, that is Alex Cooney there, CEO of Cyber Safe Kids, telling us how to post pictures of your children online safely if you don't want to delete them entirely. And thank you very much, Alex, for joining us there.
Kildare Focus with Caoimhe Harney. Text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97.
Now, myself and Owen Beattie, after the Christmas break, we were in here and we were a bit sluggish. We were saying that we weren't able to sleep and I think we were just out of kilter after the Christmas. And if you are like myself and Owen, then I'm glad to say I have Dr. Narina Ramlakhan on the line, and she is a physiologist and sleep and energy expert, and she's here to tell us all of her sleeping tips. Good afternoon, Dr. Narina.
Good afternoon, Caoimhe.
Thank you for joining us, Dr. Narina. You have 5 non-negotiables for better sleep. Can you bring us through a few of those?
Yes, indeed. Can I very quickly just give you the context of these 5 things, why they are so important?
Of course.
Because I've been helping people to sleep for over 25 years, as well as, for longer than that, solving my own sleep problems. I once suffered from insomnia, not anymore. But I've noticed that time and again, when I was working with people, whether it's, you know, I spent 10 years working in a psychiatric clinic. I've worked with so many different types of people. So even with severe sleep problems, these five things seem to make a difference. It seemed to sort of kind of do a reset to people's nervous systems and their energy levels and then their sleep. And I just make the point of stressing, you know, the importance of them in the background, because sometimes people can think, well, these look so simple, they can't possibly make a difference. But they do. And I've seen it time and time again in my years of experience. So the first one is do not skip breakfast. Eat breakfast within 30, ideally 30 minutes of rising, 30 to 45 minutes. Eat breakfast. And ideally, you'd have some protein in there as well. But eat breakfast, break the fast, stabilize your blood sugar levels, settle your nervous system so you're not running on anxiety and adrenaline and caffeine. And that brings me to the second one. Don't use caffeine as a substitute for food. So if you want your cup of tea or coffee, you can have it, but eat properly first. So eat your breakfast, stabilize your blood sugar levels, get your body in a different mode from running on caffeine and adrenaline, and then you can have your cup of tea. So the second one, reduce caffeine. No caffeine after 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And if you have sleep problems at the moment, I would cut the caffeine out, really. The third one is hydrate. Hydrate your brain. There's a lot of research now showing, indicating that the brain goes through a very complex detoxification process when we sleep at night. And in order for that detoxification process to happen efficiently and optimally, so you wake up with good energy, you need to be well hydrated. So ideally, and it's different for everyone, but ideally, you want to be drinking between a litre and a half to 2 litres of water a day. Okay. The fourth one is aim to get to bed earlier, at least four nights a week. So you're getting into bed around 9:30, 10-ish. Now, setting your sleep routine so you're going to bed earlier, it starts to attune the body into a routine. But it's also easier when you start getting into the habit. It's easier to fall asleep when you go to bed at that sort of time, because the cocktail of hormones, the light levels, melatonin levels, they all dance together so that it creates the optimum biochemical setup for you to be able to fall asleep. Now, I don't mean get into bed and be asleep, fast asleep at 9:30 or 10, but resting. You could be reading a book or listening to some relaxing music or meditating. But ideally, you're in bed around 9:30, 10, four nights a week, and you're not in bed scrolling on your devices. And that's my fifth point. Start to cultivate a healthier relationship with technology. So this means, you know, not in bed scrolling. Ideally, and people will hate me for this, ideally you'd leave the phone out of the bedroom. You know, you wouldn't have it on your bedside table beside you. You have it in another room and you don't look at it when you wake up during the night. Notice I say when. It's completely normal to wake up during the night. But when you wake up, don't look at your phone. Don't look at the time. Allow yourself to be restful. Just say, I'm just going to rest. Doesn't matter if I don't sleep now. Just practice a bit of radical acceptance. And just say to yourself, I'm just going to rest. I'm going to follow my breathing. I'm going to think of what I'm grateful for. I'm going to think of something I'm looking forward to or someone I love. And just rest. You'd be amazed at how quickly you fall asleep. So that's more than five tips, but those are my five non-negotiables.
Wow, I have to say, Dr. Narina, listen, I do all of those things. So that's probably why I don't sleep well. But in fairness, I do sleep well, but it was just after the Christmas. But like 9:30, 10, like I'm looking at that and I'm thinking, like the night is only starting at that time. You know, like it does seem very early. Like is this, would you go to bed at 10 yourself?
Oh yeah, and okay. Earlier. And I'm slightly more tired than usual today because I was out last night, and so I didn't turn my light off until about 11:15, which is late for me. I think the thing is, we need to start radically accepting that we need to value our sleep. We're living in a world that's so fast-paced, it's so driven, and people are burning out left, right, and centre. We're still emerging from this pandemic. We still haven't recovered from the last 3 years. So many people around me are exhausted. So we need to start prioritizing sleep. The thing is, nature has designed us to spend a third of our lives sleeping. When we sleep well, it catalyzes our life force. It does something for us, unlike anything else. You know, we can go to the gym and exercise, and we can eat healthily, and, you know, we can take up meditation, and all of those things are amazing and wonderful and life-changing. But there's something about getting a good night's sleep and starting to become more in tune with how nature has designed us with sleep that has the capacity to unleash your life force and your energy and you know, your optimal well-being in a way that nothing else does. So we need to start valuing it and recognizing that. And when you start to notice how good you feel, it becomes non-negotiable. You know, I look at my diary and I think, and the people who work with me and they practice the 7 to 10, for 7 to 10 days, they practice the 5 non-negotiables. They start feeling so good that sleep becomes non-negotiable, like taking a shower every day, you know?
Wow.
They don't say, I haven't got time to do that. Or, you know, it's, I think I'll wait till next month and then I'll have a shower. Because it's non-negotiable, you know, because they know how good it makes them feel.
I mean, it's amazing. Like, if you went to bed at 10 o'clock then, or 9:30, let's say, what time should you be aiming to get up for? Like 5?
Well, that's a whole other subject, because we can start talking about hours of sleep that we should get. Ideally, we want to be aiming for 8 hours a night, but it's not just 8 hours, it's, you know, 8 hours where you started, you got some sleep before midnight, and then that carried through into the early hours. But you want to get the right kind of depth of sleep, the right amount of deep sleep, the right amount of REM sleep. But, you know, when our sleep is muddied from the, you know, the stress and the choices that we've made during the day, so, we might be getting poor quality sleep because we've drunk too much caffeine, or we've had alcohol before we've gone to bed, or we've eaten too many sugary snacks, we haven't eaten properly, or we haven't had, you know, connected, warm, loving relationships, so we're taking that stress into our relationship, or we spent too much time in meetings or in our inbox or on our phones before we went to bed. All of that impacts on sleep. So even if you're getting 8 hours, it might be noisy, chaotic, muddy sleep, as I call it. So it's your quality and depth of sleep as well. The way you sleep is a reflection of how you live and how you love. Okay. You know, it all fits together. So to answer your question, 8 hours might do it for you if you get a lovely, clean sleep. A lot of people at the moment are actually needing more than that because they're getting poor quality sleep. And because, as I said, we're still recovering from the last 3 years. There's been a lot of grief. There's been loneliness. There's been isolation. There's been all sorts going on, and we're still recovering. We need to be gentler with ourselves. We need to be softer. And if we were softer in our waking hours, we probably wouldn't need to sleep as much at night. But we're so hard on ourselves, and we've expected ourselves to just get back on that treadmill and go back to being how we were 3 years ago, and we are not those human beings anymore.
Okay. Dr. Narina, I have a text in here from Johnny down in Athy, and he's asking, is it normal to wake up at least once or twice a night? Because he always
totally
does. It is.
Okay. Totally. He's normal. Well done. Pat yourself on the back. Most of us will wake anything between 5 to 10 times a night. It's normal. We've evolved with that as hunter-gatherers for our survival. We check the cave is safe and then we go back to sleep again. What isn't normal is to not get back to sleep. So, sorry, I forgot his name. Was it Tony or Danny?
Johnny.
Johnny. Johnny, don't look at the time when you wake up. Don't go on your phone, you know, and use those practices, you know, use gratitude. What am I grateful for? What do I love in my life? Who do I love in my life? Let me just breathe. Let me just rest. And put your mind in that place and let yourself drift back into that place of sleep again.
Okay, Dr. Narina, we have another message in here from James. He says that he doesn't sleep a lot during the week, going to bed quite late, but that at the weekend he sleeps in till around 11 in the morning. Is this suffice in terms of a sleeping pattern, or should he be trying to aim to get...
Nope.
Okay.
Yeah, you can't catch up. And I don't know how old he is, so, you know, particularly past the age of about 30, 35, we need to be getting that sleep where you're getting into regular routines. You know, in Chinese medicine and Ayurveda, and now Western science is also reflecting this in recent research, that the hours of sleep that you get at night, every night, they repair the body in a different way. So you can't cane yourself during the week and then try and catch up at the weekend, unless you're a teenager. But then even so, it will start to unravel you. It will start to have an impact on your health. As I was just saying to my 18-year-old teenager before you called me, you need to start getting into more regular patterns, I said to her, because you're getting worn out and you're getting run down. That's why you keep getting colds. You're going to bed too late. You're waking up too late, which is making you feel more sluggish. It's making you feel more anxious. You're getting colds all the time. Get back into a regular pattern. And we all need to do that.
Good sleep, Dr. Narina, is essential then, of course, for like proper brain development, especially in younger children, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's so, like I said, you know, there's a reason why nature has designed us to spend a third of our lives sleeping. There's an intelligence in that design. And we've become very arrogant, you know. I think with the advent of technology, we think that we're invincible and we can do everything. And we take slices off our sleep. We go to bed later, we wake up earlier, and then we wonder why, you know, the sleep industry globally is now worth billions of pounds and dollars and euros because people are getting exhausted. They all become obsessed with, how do I get better sleep now? Is it a bed? You know, is it different blankets? Is it candles? Is it oils? And all of those things can help a bit, but not nearly as much as tuning into your body and giving yourself what you really need and respecting the rhythms of your energy and the rhythms of your sleep and then making choices in your lifestyle that enable you to get that sleep that we all need, we all deserve.
And it's true what you say, Dr. Norina. I spent a couple of years out in the States. I was in New York, and I remember when I first moved over there, obviously the pace over there is much quicker than here or even over in the UK where I know you're based. And I remember saying to someone that I worked with, like, God, I'm just so tired. And he said, don't worry, honey. After a while, that just becomes normal if you just drink coffee. And that's what I did. And when I came, when I came home, I actually slept for like a couple of weeks, you know, on and off for a couple of weeks because I was actually so exhausted. Yeah. And that's kind of become normalized in modern society.
It really has. And, you know, I have US clients as well, but I have many clients, you know, in the UK, corporate clients, organizations, but they follow the same work ethic, you know. And it makes me sad, but it makes me angry as well, because sleep gives us our spirit. It gives us our life force. It gives us our energy. And these organizations are so short-sighted because they're missing out. They call it productivity because people are just sitting at their desk. And it's not. It's slavery. And people are working. They're running injured. They're running on empty. And of course, it's taking them longer to get the job done. But what if we showed up in the mornings, you know, fully energized, having slept well, having taken time to enjoy our relationships with our loved ones and taken time for ourselves to eat well and to nourish ourselves with our hobbies. You know, what if we took time to be rested and restful and to daydream so we come to work and our creative batteries are running on full power? We have our imagination. We have our full energy and our life force to bring the best of ourselves to work and leave work with the best of ourselves intact for our family and friends as well. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't that be amazing? And it is possible. And one of the ways in which we can do that is to ensure that we're getting good sleep.
Okay, Dr. Norina, one more question in here for you before I let you go. This woman says that she has a 2-year-old toddler. She refuses to go down to bed. It sometimes is 10 before she goes to sleep. How can she get her down to bed earlier? She said the children in her play school are going to bed around 7:30, 8 o'clock.
Yeah, that's not enough for a toddler. That's far too late. So when I work with children, and I don't do a lot of this sort of work anymore, I try not to be overly busy and stress myself these days. But, you know, when I work with children, I work with the parents as well. And it's awful. And I'm a parent, and I had a young child. She was once young. And I know how unforgiving it can be. You've got to get this right in yourself. When your energy is frazzled and you're sleep deprived and you're exhausted and anxious, our children pick it up, you know. So we have to be the change. If we want our children to be rested and restful, we need to mirror that and we need to model that in ourselves. And then our children pick up and they follow suit. And some of this is about, you know, us modeling those behaviors and saying to our children, right, we're going to bed now, and showing them that mummy and daddy are putting their devices away. Mummy and daddy are not wedded to their inboxes and exhausted and running on caffeine to bring them up during the day and alcohol to bring themselves down. I am making assumptions about this individual who's phoned in. But often I find in my experience that when children are not sleeping well, it can, you know, often it's linked to parents and their stresses, and they're picking it up from the parents. So when parents are grounded themselves, in themselves, and their energy is good, our children pick it up and they follow suit.
Okay, well, that is Dr. Norina Ramlakhan. She is a physiologist and sleep and energy expert, telling us there how to get a good night's sleep. And Dr. Norina, we'll definitely have you on again because that was brilliant and some great tips there. So thank you very much for coming on with us today.
Thank you, sweetheart.
Now I'm going to change tack a little bit and we're going to go over to Dr. Maeve Ogan. She's a consultant in obstetrics and gynaecology at the Rotunda Hospital in Dublin. And many of you may have heard today that researchers at Trinity College in Dublin found the number of first-time mothers giving birth by caesarean is rising steadily. Good afternoon, Dr. Ogan.
Good afternoon. How are you, Cleaver?
Not too bad. Dr. Ogan, why are we seeing this steady rise in caesareans?
Well, there's a multiplicity of reasons as to why the steady rise is being seen, and Ireland wouldn't be unique in that regard. I suppose what this particular paper was about was they interviewed doctors and midwives for their opinions on what's causing caesarean section rates to increase, what sort of factors do they consider when they're speaking with patients about caesarean section. And I suppose in very simple terms, what it highlights is that there's so many variables, including very important human factors and factors specific to the patient that influence these decisions. And it's important to integrate all of this, including the patient voice. Like, this particular paper didn't involve interviewing any patients for their experience. But, you know, it's so important that we support people to have personalised care and personalised choice. And what might be good for the population at large might not be good for the particular patient, you know. So it's important that we kind of disabuse people of the narrative of, like, caesarean section equals bad, normal birth or physiological birth or whatever you want to call it, vaginal birth equals good. Because for some people, vaginal birth is not good. Mm. And for other people, caesarean section is not good. And it's just important that we talk with our patients, make the right decision for that particular patient, and use the various things that influence them and the various things that influence us to come up with the best decision for them, you know. But childbirth isn't always easy, you know.
Yeah. Dr. Ogan, then, if you can tell us, you know, a couple of the factors that did contribute to a rise in caesareans, like what were some of them?
Yeah. So some of the things were, you know, with other things, for example, if you have clinical guidelines and you say, well, if X happens, you do Y, or if A happens, you do B, it was found that they were part of the decision making around doing a caesarean section. But it was more than that, because it depended on the particular patient and their wishes. For example, somebody may very much have wanted a normal birth, but then they went a week or 10 days overdue and the neck of the womb wasn't ready to be induced. And, you know, perhaps if they had been induced, the induction would have been unsuccessful. And after 24 hours of induction, they might have ended up with a section. And in that situation, they might have said, do you know what, I'll have a planned section instead. And then you have somebody else with the exact same scenario who says, no, you know what, I'll give induction a go. And maybe 36 hours later, they'd have had a totally uneventful birth. And I think, so what it shows is that it's not just about having a guideline. And for 100% of people who come through the hospital, you do it this way. And, you know, for 100% with another particular scenario, you do it that way. It's about personalising the care and choice. The other thing that was identified was that midwives and doctors were naturally very aware of the risk of adverse outcomes, and that they strove very much to mitigate the risk of adverse outcomes. So sometimes that involves intervening earlier when it looks like the writing is on the wall for something not panning out how it might be hoped for, or how the parents might want it, and how the midwives and doctors might want it. So because of that, you know, sometimes that's called, or that's talked about as, like, defensive medicine, which I think isn't necessarily a nice term, because it sort of implies you're not really thinking about the person, you're only thinking about yourself as a doctor or midwife and protecting yourself. Whereas actually what you're trying to do in that context is protect the parents from an adverse outcome as well. And, you know, it comes down to informed consent, keeping people informed at all times, telling them what's happening, telling them what you expect might happen, where the sort of forks in the road are for different things. And, you know, antenatal education comes into it as well. You know, pregnancy is 40 weeks long, and there's lots of opportunities for people to read, to watch programs, to look at YouTube videos, and indeed to attend face-to-face antenatal classes. That's one of the benefits of COVID now being over, there's opportunity, or COVID being limited, maybe not over, there are opportunities for us to return to some of those more traditional educational pathways where people can discuss, you know, their options in terms of pregnancy care and birth care and make their own plans and their own preferences.
Okay.
But I suppose it's important not to instill fear in people. This isn't black and white. Maternity care isn't black and white. No two patients are exactly the same. And it's really important that people are supported to ask questions, to discuss their particular scenario. And, you know, sometimes we leave people and something, some adverse outcome might have happened their sister. There's no genetic reason why it might happen them. But naturally, that patient is more concerned about that particular thing happening to them because it happened to somebody that they know and love very well, you know. Yeah. So talking to your doctor or your midwife about your own particular care with your own set of circumstances hopefully should help people, you know, come up with the right decision for them. And ultimately, at the end of it all, when their baby is born, feeling they've had a positive birth experience. Because safety and psychosocial kind of well-being and birth satisfaction are all really valuable things. It's not just about having a safe birth. It's also about feeling that it went your way, or you understood what was happening, or you were part of it, you know?
Dr. Hogan, I just want to ask you something here, because one obstetrician told researchers in this study that many Irish women giving birth were fat, old and short compared to women in the Netherlands, for example. Is that something you believe to be true?
Isn't that just such a horrible statement?
Mm.
I think it's absolutely awful. It's so pejorative. It's completely unhelpful. It's victim blaming, and there's just, it's really not a pleasant statement. And yes, for sure, like, you know, Sweden does have a relatively low cesarean section rate. Although that being said, crude cesarean section rates really are not necessarily a marker of safety. And, you know, there was lots of recent safety reports in the NHS where they talked about the importance of personalised care and not just focusing on normal birth, and that narrative can be dangerous. But in any case, you know, when there are these reports where they're just comparing people in the Netherlands, people in Sweden, you know, there can be lots of differences. But you know, using that kind of terminology, negative terminology, and as I say, victim blaming, and, you know, I mean, a person's age is a person's age. It's absolutely not something they can change, you know. So it's about working with that person. And if it is that you really feel the writing is on the wall, that this baby is most likely to be born by cesarean section, well, as a doctor or midwife, we owe it to that patient to say, look, given your particular circumstances, generally people in your set, with your set of circumstances, you know, would have like an 8 out of 10 chance of a section, you know, for their own safety. Well, then work with the person, discuss it, discuss the pros and the cons. Maybe the patient says, yes, I understand it, you know, only 8 out of 10 chance it'll be a section, but actually I want to give it every chance that I'm the 2 out of 10. And then you work with them and, you know, support them through that, as long as it's safe to do so. But that kind of pejorative terminology is really very negative and doesn't help anybody.
Lastly, Dr. Hogan, before I let you go, is there any correlation between age and cesarean sections?
Yes, there is. But again, it's not a it's not black and white that you can say, oh, you know, everybody over 40 has a section, nobody under 40 doesn't have a section. It comes down to the fact of how many babies the person has had. So, for example, if it's a woman having her fourth baby over the age of 40, her cesarean section rate, if she had normal births before, will be much lower than somebody who's having their first baby over the age of 40. The other thing is, sometimes things that have happened, people will influence it, influence earlier recourse to cesarean section. So, for example, a person who's over 40 and has had 4 cycles of IVF, you know, her tolerance of risk, her acceptance of risk may be very different to somebody who's got pregnant spontaneously, has sailed through their pregnancy, has no issues or concerns or worries. All her sisters have had normal births. She just expects it's going to be a normal birth. So while her cesarean section rate would be higher than someone who's 20, nevertheless, she may be very happy to anticipate normal birth. So it's not black and white. And I think it comes down to these human factors, that we are all human. We are all different. No two pregnant women are exactly identical. And consequently, the outcomes are not necessarily going to be identical. So it's about talking to their own doctor or midwife about their own particular risks and indeed their own particular preferences.
We do have one message in here, 208-33-97-97-97. Jenny says, women nowadays are too posh to push, in my opinion. Back in my day, we always had the natural birth, obviously, vaginal there. Is that true, Dr. Ogan? Do people, want cesareans? Do they look for planned cesareans much more these days?
There are some women who want a planned cesarean, but they have usually researched it. They have spoken to a lot of people. They may have gone to a planned cesarean antenatal class, and they have reviewed their own particular risks and preferences and determined why that is something that they want to do. By far, the majority of people don't want a planned cesarean section, but may end up needing a cesarean section for a particular reason. And again, I think that too posh to push thing is not very pleasant. Mm. You know, cesarean section is not an easy option. I had a normal birth and I had a cesarean section. And so I understand the recovery from both. And cesarean section is not an easy option. That doesn't necessarily mean it's the wrong option. For some people, it may well be entirely an appropriate option. And, you know, this kind of negative pitting women against women thing is just not helpful to anybody.
Okay, well, that is Dr. Maeve Ogan, their consultant in obstetrics and gynaecology at the Rotunda Hospital in Dublin. Researchers at Trinity College in Dublin have found that the number of first-time mothers giving birth by cesarean is rising steadily. And thank you very much to Dr. Ogan there for joining us. Now, today marks the one-year anniversary of Aisling Murphy's murder. The 23-year-old school teacher was fatally attacked while jogging along a canal near Tullamore on the 12th of January last year. And I'm joined now on the line by Ivana Utechak. She is the Violence Against Women Coordinator at the National Women's Council. And she's here to tell us why frontline services are calling for greater action on the government's zero tolerance strategy. Good afternoon, Ivana.
Hi, good afternoon.
Ivana, what are you at the National Women's Council calling for?
Well, we're calling, first of all, to implement the strategy that you're talking about that puts very clear and speaks about zero tolerance to violence against women. And this is because, as we know, a femicide or the murder of Aisling is really the tip of the iceberg of a wide range of violence that exists in Irish society. So I suppose what it's very important from this strategy is that it tackles all the aspects of violence against women. This is from prevention to the protection of victims and survivors, prosecution and policy. But I think it's very important to highlight this is a strategy, so it's a promise. So we need to see this strategy implemented and well-resourced.
We saw a huge movement there a couple of years ago, the hashtag MeToo movement. And then, of course, last year when Aisling Murphy was murdered, there was a massive outcry and outpour of, I suppose, just anger at why this would happen to someone who's just innocently going on a run. Obviously, you at the National Women's Council see this kind of thing more so on a daily basis on the work on the ground that you do, Ivana.
Yes, absolutely. These shocking incidents really, I suppose, they allowed for a conversation and to talk publicly about these issues. But it is important to highlight that since Aisling was murdered, another 11 women have been murdered throughout the year. So obviously there's still a lot to be done around these issues. And so, yes, absolutely.
Okay. I suppose when we talk about violence against women, you know, it can happen from anywhere in the home, you know, domestically. Of course, it can happen at work. And then, of course, with strangers, us, the public, what can we do to try and prevent that?
Well, there's not an easy answer for that. But one of the things that we're very clear about is that this needs to start at very early ages. So it is very important that children get a proper curricula to prevent violence against women. The social, personal and health education, as well as the relationship and sexuality education, is very important that it's mandatory from very early ages. So we can all start having this conversation very early. So it's not the likes of Andrew Tate or pornography who teach children about violence against women, because we know that these very harmful messages are full of violence and they're full of normalization of violence against women. But then everyone has a role. And especially, I would say, men. We need to talk about men a lot more and the capacity that men have to stop this normalization of violence, from maybe silly jokes that are about rape or silly jokes that are exactly that, normalize violence. So we all have a role to prevent violence, from the smallest things to the bigger things.
Yeah, we've seen over the last few weeks, especially, I don't know if you've been following it yourself, Ivana, Andrew Tate, who, you know, he's come to prominence and he says some awful things about women, you know, like if a woman talks out of turn, slap her in the face and this kind of thing. And a lot of young men find him very impressionable. They think he's funny. And I know just in recent days, some senior ministers have come out against it and said, like, look, it needs to be nipped in the bud. Obviously, this is happening in schools as well, where some young boys, maybe some girls, think that this is okay too. Have you seen that much yourself?
Yes, we have. And it has been a very huge concern that these harmful speeches are growing. So I suppose the main thing is that teachers need to have the capacity to speak about these issues, but also parents. Everyone needs to be able to talk to these, especially young boys, and accompany them to see why these harmful speeches are wrong, because they're obviously very vulnerable, so they won't know, and we can't ignore it. So, as I said, it's very important that anyone has the capacity to have these conversations, because sometimes they're not easy conversations. So training is key.
Okay, training is key there. And then I suppose, Ivana, would you have any tips yourself for mothers maybe on how to broach a subject like that with their younger children? I know you're saying specifically boys, but boys and girls, how do they say something like that without being too lecturey? And then also, you know, just to say something like this isn't a joke.
Absolutely. As you said, it's not about getting lectury. I think that gets things harder. We need to listen why they think, because normally they don't have a lot of arguments to really sustain this kind of things, because there isn't. So we need to listen to their concerns and why they feel that way, and try to really get to the root of why they're thinking this, instead of telling them, instead of completely lecture them, because I don't think that will work, because they can't express what they're feeling. And instead of sharing with parents, with teachers and others, they will just keep it to themselves and they will remain believing that. So that is the biggest fear, I suppose.
Okay, well, that is Ivana Juchak there, Violence Against Women Coordinator at the National Women's Council, and they are calling for greater action on the government's zero tolerance strategy towards violence against women. And today, of course, marking 1 year since the death of Aisling Murphy. Thank you very much, Ivana, for joining us. That's all we have time for today. I'll be back again tomorrow at the same time between 2 and 3.